Wave Radio.
Hi, you're listening to The Floating Point on Rave Pubs Radio. I'm your host, Hope Roth. We're coming to you from the Infocom show floor. We're set up in the Kramer booth. Thank you to Kramer for letting us have some space. And thank you to our sponsor, Ingram Micro, for all your AV and IT needs. I'm here with my co-host, Christopher Tatton.
Good morning.
And we're with David Thorson of AVI SPL. Did I get your name right?
That's correct. David Thorson. Glad to be here, Hope.
Thank you. And Dan Jackson from Crestron.
How you doing?
Doing pretty good. I got my coffee, so I'm good. So we are actually here before the show opens. We all snuck in. Well, some of us did. So we're going to sort of talk about Infocom a little more generally, just because we have not actually walked the show floor yet. But we want to thank you guys for joining us. We wanted to talk a little bit about the R&D process. Dan and David, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves? Sorry. I'll start with you, Dan.
So my title at Crestron now is Manager of Research and Development, so hopefully I know a little bit about the research and development process.
That is what reminded me that I forgot to ask who you are. I know who you are. Yeah. Our listeners do not. Yeah.
My background, though, was Crestron programming. I came out of school about 12 years ago and started out as a then CAPE, now CSP effectively, but I was out there in the field programming systems. That was my background. I'm a trained computer engineer. And after a short stint in the field, I came back to the mothership at Crestron to really do some development. And you know, a lot of this, I cover everything nowadays, but I focused on digital media for many years. Capture, Fusion, and Pinpoint is where my focus is now.
Okay, great. Thank you. And David, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So my job title is Senior Manager of Programming Architecture. And similar to Dan, I joined this industry from a computer science degree. I started out with a smaller integrator, and then I did IT programming, web development, and database and SQL .NET application for a few years, and then came back in the AV industry and been a programmer ever since. And my job entails today, I oversee our group called TSG, so we do standards and development, user interface design, module development, and we support AVI SPL nationally and around the world.
That's great. Apparently we're cornering the market on AV programmers with CompSci degrees, because I think pretty much everybody on the show has so far, which is not generally the case, but...
It's good that more of that is coming into the industry, I think.
Yeah, I think that's great. All of my favorite programmers, well... I'm going to get myself into trouble with that one. Most of my favorite programmers have a CompSci degree. All right, so Dan, we wanted to talk a little bit about the R&D process, because I think a lot of people just kind of see the product announcements and they don't really think about what's happening behind the scenes. Is Infocom sort of like the end of the road for you in terms of like this is what you're trying to get to? We're just sort of wondering if this is sort of the culmination of stuff or if you're already working on things for next year.
Well... So a lot of people, you know, you see a product come out and you think, oh, that's great. You know, it was those guys thought of it and they brought it to market. What you don't realize is just how far ahead of time we had to be thinking about those things before we brought it to market. So, you know, a good example of that is our DMPS 50, 100, 150 product line. You know, there's a number of other products in that line. I looked, you know, we've been shipping that for 18 months now. I'm going to get myself in trouble by not really knowing, but I think it's about 18 months. I looked at the original documents we did when we were penning that thing up, and it was early 2011.
Oh, wow.
So that shows you just how far in advance you really have to kind of lay down the groundwork for a product. And that's just the reality, especially when you're bringing up a new platform. When you're making small tweaks to an existing platform, it's not, you know, it's the time can be as short as 12 months. In hardware, you effectively have these much longer cycles because there's a, you know, investigation, development, qualification, spooling up your production factory, getting stuff in stock because we have to have it in stock before we can release it, and then getting it to market. So the minimum is 12 months, but as I told you, on some of those bigger endeavors, it can be 36 months or even more.
I'd like to ask a question about that part, Dan, where you mentioned sort of that planning so far ahead. Where do you source a lot of your input, sort of what to build in? Does it come from executive levels, we need to get this part of the market? Are there engineers that say we need to have this one feature? Or is it a little bit of both? Or where's the more or less where that kind of input comes from? And how do you get to input into that?
So a lot of what my group does is we watch the market for sort of two things. Number one, business trends, you know, things that are changing. Obviously, the growth of the huddle room is a thing everybody's been talking about for a long time now. The small solutions, the consistent enterprise-wide solutions. So we watch those market business trends. you know, kind of from a high level, just going around talking to people. Luckily, you know, at Crestron, we have a huge sales force, right? I think at Infocom alone, we've brought in about 100 Crestron-owned salespeople. So we just have an incredible reach into the market to figure out what's going on across all these different spaces. And we also get access to a lot of end users nowadays, which has been an incredible benefit. We're in it, you know, the biggest Fortune 100 companies, and those companies really give us insight into their needs and their wants, so we can roll that in. But the other half of it is we have to watch the technology trends. You know, how is technology shifting to be able to enable all sorts of these new solutions, streaming and other of those things that are coming along? We've seen that for years. And part of that's through just, okay, you see what's happening in the market, but we actually have access to all these chip manufacturers and vendors that are really producing things even further ahead of time. Because if you think about how long ahead it takes to actually manufacture a piece of silicon, get it into a circuit, and then integrate it into products, you're talking longer than 36 months that some of those chip manufacturers have to be looking ahead in the market. So the fact that we get access to those guys, we work with them, we see the roadmaps, we see where those things are going, helps roll into us understanding what's going to be possible with technology. You meld that with the business case in the market, and out pops, you know, the products.
So an example of that, I know that I got an email this morning discussing your new DSP products that you guys are announcing today. So how far along in the development process were you, like, say, at Infocom last year? Like,
we were actually planning on releasing like Infocom last year.
Oh, really?
So yeah, I mean, that
pushed back.
That, you know, but that's a whole other story. But especially with the DSPs, you know, there's a lot of established brands out there today. We knew we had to be perfect on that one. You can't come out with a solution that has a hiccup too, or a hiccup here or there, because that's just not acceptable in the market today. So what we've done with that product is actually had a huge, huge, I won't even call it beta cycle, but sort of an early release cycle. We have an audio council of a large number of integrators and consultants and other people that have been literally playing with that product, working with that product for a year now as we brought it to market. So we have all of this, you know, established use of that product, knowledge of that product already going in by the time we release. So that product has basically been ready. I mean, honestly, we probably started development on that almost 5 years ago.
And one thing I'd ask about that, the hardware is really important, but I'd be curious on how, at what point during the development of the hardware do you start working on the software applications for that product? Because I know what the new DSP, the plan is, and the tool set is to merge the DSP configuration. Being a programmer, I don't always consider DSP programming, so I usually call it DSP configuration, but that's just me.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then
tying the software Crestron programming into it. What's that going to be like, and how did that play? Did you have input into that, and how long all the process does that start?
Yeah, I mean, when you're laying down the architecture, you have to do that very early up front. Okay, what are these base protocols going to be? How are these devices all going to talk to one another? Are they going to have the performance? Are you going to be able to, for instance, get a VU meter in the software, right? Which is very specific timing constraints. So some of those performance needs have to be laid down at, you know, as you're creating the first concept of the product. And then as you start to figure out how the blocks work together, you know, they kind of work in parallel. So our software and hardware teams, I mean, they're either in the same building or they're 100 yards apart. So these teams have been working very closely together basically the entire time for the development.
That's great. Can you tell us a little bit more about the product and like how you think it differentiates itself from some of the existing products that are out there?
Yeah, so that product, and I have been actually less involved with that product than I have with other products, because my back, you know, as one of the newer guys, I've been in the industry 10 years, I'm still kind of considered a newer guy, I think, in a lot of circles. You know, networking and digital video were really my specialties. So I personally backed off on that product a little bit, because there's so much to know about audio that I was just didn't have that background. But a lot of what we were trying to do with the DSP was make it easier to go out there and deploy it and give you just incredible audio specifications. So there's 6 points that we tried to hit with that product, and now from memory, I'm not going to get all 6, but you know, so one of those best-in-class audio specifications, it was ease of programming, right? So the ability to drop that DSP in there and then have it automatically brought out into your touchscreens or all of your other UIs, so you didn't have to recreate a huge amount of the user interface. The whole channel chip programming methodology, so it's kind of a nice blend between a complete freeform DSP, which gives you a lot of flexibility, but has to have an incredibly trained person to really make it sing and work well, or else you're going to get yourself into trouble. But yet gives you a lot more flexibility than a completely fixed DSP would give you, right? So we tried to hit all of these things that really honestly just came had come back to us as feedback from customers over the years. You know, when we look at, you know, where our systems get integrated, obviously DSPs have been probably the most integrated product along with video conferencing units for the last 7 or 8 years. So it's the problems were very well known. So it was very easy for us to go out there and say, we know exactly how to fix all these things and craft a better solution.
That's great.
I'm curious about that beta cycle, because you mentioned a year where people have it. Has Crestron, have you guys changed your approach? Because I've also seen a change in the way that you guys release, say, firmware or software updates. It seems to be sort of these quiet rollouts where you maybe, you know, I'll give the Fusion SSI modules are another example. They're in the database, so people who are looking for them will find them, but they're not being sort of announced.
They're not necessarily advertised as, hey, yeah, here's this new stuff.
Yeah, right. So that is it seems like a quiet beta almost, but I know the DSP is more tactical, it sounds like. But has Crestron changed their approach to getting extending that beta, or what's the tactical?
We've really tried to be more open with the development, and honestly just go to more of what you would consider like a modern software development rollout, right? So if we started up this site called Crestron Labs, I want to say probably about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe even earlier than that, because it really kind of started with the 3-series processors. And so this Crestron Labs site is a place where all these authorized programmers can go and have interaction with our engineers without people like me or sales guys getting in the way of the conversation to really figure out all these low-level things and get access to some of these early things. So a lot of the new things that we create go on Crestron Labs, get some really early feedback from some people who are incredibly passionate about Crestron, and it's great early feedback. We had, just as an example, we created this new program for dynamic drivers to be able to swap out driver models and everything. We posted the initial version at Crestron Labs.
Yeah, I remember there was a lot of feedback on that and a lot of stuff.
A lot of people didn't like the exact direction, and we changed it completely. Honestly, we came back and said, we're going to go do something a little bit different. We're going to take that feedback into account. And the last release that was posted in April or May had no feedback. You know, there was nobody coming back. Look, you never get good feedback. People just complain when it's broken, which is fine. That's how it
works. People when I like it, what they're doing.
But you're right. The general rule of thumb is no news is good news.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you put it out there, and it's good because, you know, this cycle allows us to make sure that we understand what the market needs are by doing things like that. You know, at a detailed level, because at a high level, it's easy to understand the market needs, but of course, when you start putting the bits and bytes together, sometimes it can go a little sideways. So by doing these quieter things, by doing early beta releases, we really can capture that feedback into the product that eventually gets out there.
So do you ever run into issues where the technology industry just changes so quickly, but the development cycle is very long? So do you ever find yourself sort of halfway down a path and realizing, oh wow, nobody's doing this anymore, or oh, we need to get on to doing this?
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm never happy with how long it takes to bring our products to market. I mean, that's just general, right? We always want it tomorrow, right? Because you see a need, you want to be able to fill it. You want to be able to address that right away. So I'm...
Well, yeah, and a lot of this industry is being able to strike while the iron is hot.
Right, right. But now, so we've actually gone in. There were certain products that, you know, have never brought it to market. They were very close. There was a famous, you know, it was a wireless low latency audio product that we did actually in partnership with Microsoft 7 or 8 years ago. It was a little bit more targeted towards the residential space, but knowing that the technology would have gone to commercial space, and we just could not get the unit price down to where we knew it needed to be. And so we poured $2 million of development into this product, and we just had to drop it. We just didn't get there. So there are a decent number of things that go down that road, and we go, it was good. I mean, look, it's good to learn. It's good to find that information out, and then let's go a different direction.
Well, and hopefully some of the lessons that you learned, you know, going through that product, you were able to incorporate it into your new DSP box.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, look, you always learn. You learn by doing really effectively nowadays. You know, we learn, you know, so even things that are not necessarily, I wouldn't call them failures, but things that you look at it and you go, we shouldn't do this. Well, now we know not to do that on the main products, right? We learned that this is a bad technology to use or a bad way of doing it. Let's do it some other way. So there is a pruning process that happens before the products get out there.
Yeah. How often do you think after the product is released in the wild, does the R&D department get feedback, like, back about that product to change future direction?
Continuously, honestly. So those sales reps are out there all day, every day, on the streets, gathering that feedback. And then we also reach out in plenty of other ways. But the fact that we have that, you know, 100 person strong just in the commercial market sales force is incredible amount of feedback, because those guys are having 10, 15 meetings a week with customers. We collect all that feedback and it goes directly back to me, or not directly back to me, but it makes its way back to me and helps validate all of the things that we're doing or doing differently.
And what are those some really important points of that process? Because you mentioned some of the traditional software development's life cycle, which we call an agile process where you're constantly redeveloping. It's feedback from customers, salespeople, you have engineering, you have application development. What are some of those critical points that you have really ingrained in the process that help keep that formalized, help keep it on track?
So we used to, if you think back 10 years ago when I was really getting started at Crestron, a lot of products didn't necessarily get big firmware updates, right? It was a product that was released out into the market. If there were bugs, you fix it, but there weren't necessarily a whole lot of features. That whole concept has completely shifted, right? As you pointed out, digital media was released in 2009. I can't even tell you how many features are in digital media now compared to when it released, because it's a platform that gets updated. So it's a traditional software development cycle. You take the feedback in, the technology manager's responsibility is to collect all that feedback, put it into a product requirements, and that gets vetted. Everybody in engineering sees that, gets a chance to have some input. We formalize that document, it goes out, gets turned into a spec by the engineers, they work on it, and then it gets released. But it really is sort of a continuous collection of feedback, and then we prioritize it and lock it in as a feature set in the product requirements.
That's really great to hear that, because a lot of manufacturers, I think, have had to take to that approach where it used to be you design a product, you drop it on the doorstep, and you say, well, hey, if you want a new feature, let's re-justify, let's restart that whole process. But now it seems that engineering R&D are along for the whole ride and the whole life cycle of that product.
Yeah, and actually one of the big shifts is we have dedicated teams for specific things. There's a digital media team. Those guys don't work on anything but digital media. There's an AV framework team. Those guys don't work on anything but AV framework. Same with 3-Series. So they're just on that product. They know it throughout. They're not getting bounced around between all of these different products. So it really helps those teams work more closely together. So even though we've grown to, I don't even know the real number nowadays, I'm about 450 engineers.
Well, that's an enormous staff.
I mean, it's really kind of incredible when you think about it. We're just in New Jersey alone, we're across 3 different buildings now. But those teams can work closely together to get those products out there.
Where do you guys do the overlap, the interplay between the different, like you mentioned, the DAP framework and the DM and the software tools? How do you guys blend it, knowing that, the DMPS would probably be the perfect example, right, where you had the DM needed to merge with a 3-Series processor? Is it the product managers of that, or is it at the engineering level? Who keeps those in line to make sure that they do play well together?
I mean, honestly, everybody.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to play well at that point. Every single product gets a single owner as a technology manager, right? So DMPS has a control system, has audio, has video, has all those things. But one of the TMs, it could change, depending on the product. One of the TMs owns the product, but of course works with all the other TMs to make sure it's happening. We actually have engineering directors for each functional category. So we're broken down by functions. So we have a hardware director, firmware director, mechanical, software tools, software architecture director. So those, they work across all those different products. Those directors obviously meet all the time to work on these things.
So if we could talk about software tools for a second. I know one of the big things in some of your more recent products has been the web-based interface that's been added to DMPS 3.4K, 150, et cetera. Almost kind of removing that product from some of their traditional software tools like Toolbox a little bit, where you're not using Toolbox to configure it. How is that decision determined? Like, where did that come along in the R&D process? And do you think that that's a really great solution, or do you think that it could use some work? Or,
well, so the real reason for that is sort of this bigger, again, going back to market shifts, as we shift over to enterprise deployments, the scale of the deployments we're doing nowadays is just so much more massive than it used to be. 10 years ago, a 20 room deployment was a big deal. Nowadays, you're seeing deployments in the thousands in some cases, right? So manageability becomes absolutely critical. And so when you look about, try to figure out how exactly do I update dozens to hundreds of rooms at a time? How do I keep these things aligned? you want to be able to use standard software protocols so that somebody who's updating these things can use standard off-the-shelf tools, right? So that's why we shifted to, hey, you can SFTP the firmware up to the device. You can pull down configuration files. All those things can be done with standard tools, so we don't have to go loading a Crestron software program that you have to funnel all your commands through. You can use the same tool set you use every day for all of your other things, right? And I think that's just the general direction that we're going to, where we're not locking you into the Crestron tool set. We're becoming an integration piece, so you can work with the tools that you use for your other things.
Do you think that having, you know, each product with its own web browser built or web server built in for configuration, do you think that somehow somewhat limits you in the ability to script it at all?
Well, you don't necessarily script the web browser, right? We also have scripting built in.
Well,
right?
I guess what I'm saying is, let's say you have like 20 of these boxes and you're trying to update them all, like update firmware. Obviously, SFTP is something you can script. There's programs out there that you can script, but currently with that solution, you need to touch every box with the web browser.
Well, it sounds like there's a config file backup, right? So you can pull the settings out and
No, with AV Framework though, which we're, I think, just releasing today, this new version of AV Framework, all the configuration settings are stored in a series of XML files effectively that can all be backed up and automated. So I kind of look at it like it's two different interfaces. You have the web interface, which is I'm touching one box to try and, do whatever I need to do on a specific box. And then there's the scriptable interface, which is a combination of, things like SSH and SFTP to be able to script those, a series of boxes together. And we'll always have both solutions because you obviously need to be able to touch one box at a time, but you also need to have your manageability and script a whole series of boxes.
Great. It sounds like the web browser is merely an addition to the traditional interfacing that you guys already have for your products.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's just expected in products today to be able to go in with a web browser. But it also, comes with other, I'm not gonna say challenges, but requirements, because you can't just go slap a web browser on a product in an enterprise that's not, locked down with real password protections, with Active Directory integration, with audit trails. I mean, all those security things come along with it, so we had to put all those other backends in place so that you don't just have a random web server sitting all over people's networks without any security. You have to have these other pieces too, but it just becomes expected today.
Was there anything fundamentally different about it? Because one of the things we realized when we started using the new 8x1s was it's got the embedded 3 series processor, so it's only compatible with a 3 series control system. Is that, we're going to start to see more of that, where those switchers are going to be only 3 series compatible for control?
It's been, I want to say, 6 years now, 5 years now since we've moved over to the 3 series, and so we always make things backwards compatible. Again, at some point, obviously not a lot of the stuff we do today, or not everything we do, is X series compatible. At some point, you kind of have to...
You have to have a clean break.
Over to it, right? So we've had an incredibly long transition period, and we've needed to because people have 2 series products everywhere in the enterprise, and so we've had that support for an incredibly long time, but as you move to some of the newer solutions, you may try to make decisions about, okay, what's the real impact if we get all these benefits by picking a specific architecture in a specific direction, but if we go that way, what do we lose? Okay, in this case, we couldn't make it compatible with the 2 series in that way. You start to make those trade-offs at a certain point. So we've just sort of reached that point, I think, a little bit with the 2 series, where we've moved all the development over to the all the new development over to 3 series. We're still doing all bug fixes and security patches and all that stuff.
But you, at this point, you've end of life the vast majority of the 2 series processors?
Yes, well, anything that had a direct replacement. And part of that's just because we want to make sure people are getting the best stuff, right? Somebody's going to buy a 2 series and not realize it doesn't have all of the security and all the other bits that come with it. We don't want to be putting that solution out there in the market if we can help it. So if we can move people over to the 3 series, and we kept all the products at the same price effectively. So there was really no reason to buy the 2 series when the 3 series was sitting there at the exact same price. So yeah, we try to move things over to the new platform as we can, but we still have some 2 series things out there, the MPC products and a couple of the other solutions.
I would like to put in a pitch, because we have you on the show with us right now, for a 3 series GL pack. That would be just fantastic for me personally.
Yeah, well, I'm buying a house next week, actually, so I'm starting to feel
congratulations.
All those things.
I do a lot of commercial lighting, and I've started to get a lot more into scripting and XML files, and then you get to a building with 400 GL packs, and it all just comes to a screeching halt. I mean, there's usually some AP3s in there, but...
Yeah.
I'd like to ask about a specific product. Is there anything you can tell us about the HDMD 400? That seems to be a very versatile product. It's been very attractive for our design engineers. We've installed a lot of them. Is there anything you can tell us about how that product came to market? And how it, because it seems to be, it can be an out-of-the-box one. It can also be interfaced with a control system. It's very new for us. We're adopting a lot of them, like I said. So anything you can tell us about how that came
about? It's also kind of different than a lot of the other products that you guys have out there. It's kind of its own category.
Right. We saw the need for these low-cost solutions that are out there. And effectively, you know, we saw you can build a, I'll call them like a point-to-point sort of, you know, plug-and-play laptop room solution with digital media, right? Because you can take a DM transmitter and plug it into a DM receiver. That was designed from the beginning, nice point-to-point solution. It was great, but it was a little more expensive than it really needed to be because it had all of the benefits of digital media and all the other stuff that comes with it, which if you're just doing a really basic point-to-point solution, you didn't necessarily need all the time. So we said, let's craft a product for that space where it's literally just this very low-cost room. So you can get in, plug and play, configure a couple things from a web browser and walk away. I mean, you go into the room and you set it up in 20 minutes. We saw that need, and so we said we need to bring this to market, and it's been, absolutely incredibly successful for us, that particular product.
Yeah, I mean, from the programming perspective, it's got a beautiful solution to it, but I'd also say it brings sort of an angle of almost fear for a programmer's perspective in those kinds of rooms, right? And we know why. It seems like it's limits the need for a programmer, right? But I'd say the other thing, not just the product itself, but with the AV hub that goes with it, right? That is almost, to me, like another one of those things where Crestron's extending from the cloud to be able to manage and set up control systems where, you know, the out-of-box solution with the scheduled panels has been one for a long time where you just plug on the wall and Fusion, you get the Crestron connected displays. Now you've got this hub that essentially can turn a whole room into a managed room. Any more plans to extend that hub's capabilities to other hardware or other features, or is that something you were involved with?
So the AV Framework Hub was really designed to be able to take those basic solutions, so things like the HDMD 400, I think that's what it covers today. It'll also cover the 4x1, the 2x1, some of the other Essentials line of switchers. Take those things and be able to integrate them with Fusion in the cloud, do some basic automation in the room and other things. To take those low-cost solutions and really make them a managed piece. Look, it's something that people just sort of expect in a room today. You know, we crafted this whole line because we saw that people were putting in very basic solutions, but with no manageability, which when you think about it, it's kind of crazy. You know, where's the first place when push comes to shove with a budget, where can you save the most money? It's in the tiny rooms because there's so many of them. So people just start trimming that budget. They go from 500 to 400, you know, whatever it is, they start cutting that down. We said that's crazy because you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, right? So let's make those a managed solution and really get those into Fusion. So I don't necessarily think of those as taking from programmers because programmers weren't getting into those rooms anyways, right?
I'll be honest with you, as a programmer, I don't like doing those rooms. They're boring.
I hate doing those rooms.
It's the grunt work.
What I find I'm doing more and more these days, and part of it is the commercial lighting, but part of it is just the way of our industry, is you get into industries of scale and all of a sudden you're doing a whole building. Mm-hmm. And so instead of looking at, the nitty-gritty details of one little room, you're looking at how the whole building's going to work, how you're going to manage it, how you're going to deploy it, how you're going to sort of do it centrally. And I honestly would rather do that anyways.
And to me, that's where you really add the value. You know, you got to look long term at where you're adding value, right? Because if the value isn't there, the money's not going to be there at some point either, right? So these very low cost solutions, let's go in, let's get those done. That's great. That means where programmers really start to add value is those pieces of integration, right? Integration into BackNet, some of these other back end IT systems. You know, with your background in creating some of these system architectures, you know, with on the IT side. I mean, I think there's so much value that can be done there. You know, imagine taking, the data that's getting collected by Fusion and all these other things, bringing it into dashboards and other things for people to be able to manage it, integrating it with, the call statistics from your audio and video conferencing devices to create real information and knowledge out of it. I think those types of higher level sort of campus-wide integrations is going to be key going forward that's where the value is going to be created by the Crestron.
And I'll tie that back to something you said earlier about you guys only hear about the bad stuff on labs. We have a similar sort of in our help desk and support, right? They only call us when something's broken. So we are using Fusion in those reports and gathering that data to not just say, here's the tickets that have been opened and here's the resolution of those tickets, but we're also able to say this uptime of this room is well, up of 99%, right? So yeah, you might have had one issue where something failed, but really you're getting great experience overall. So that has allowed us to do that. And I'm excited to see the hub extend us into more of those rooms like you talked about.
And I love data for the reason that you brought up, because it cuts through a lot of the just BS, kind of the argument.
The human nature of it.
Right. Yeah.
You mean all of those people that email and say, this conference room never works.
Never work,
right,
yeah.
Right, the bar argument of it all. You know, it's the data cuts through and says, no, look, your room's had a 99.9% uptime, and it helps you as an integrator deploying those solutions say, look at what we're providing to you. Here's the value. Your customer can then take that up the chain and say, look, this is why we need this money for these rooms. This is why we're putting these solutions in, because look at the value we're getting out of it. If you don't have that data, you're just relying on anecdotes and other things to justify your budget.
They like to say the plural of anecdote is not data.
Yeah.
Well, it's also not just those incident reports, but we're also able to bring in the actual room utilization with it too. So you're also getting space utilization metrics with the actual statistics of uptime and downtime, right? So you start, because that's always a really important question when you're doing monitoring of rooms. Are people actually using them, right? But we've gotten some interesting requests because, of course, you book a room, you schedule a room, so you know how often it's used. But we've had customers that want to know, well, how often are people squatting in the room? Meaning they didn't book it right or they didn't follow the process, but the motion sensor found that they were there, and then they dialed this number.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, then you got people just room hopping, right? And that's not the way to utilize them the best way. So you can combine some of those other things, and sometimes when we'll deploy like a new programming feature or a new UI, we're starting to build in actual feedback from the user at the end of the meeting, right? Was this a good experience or bad experience? Like a rating system at the close of the meeting, it would give us some investigation, right? Or if we deploy a scheduling, you know, autopilot dialing type feature where you just walk in, you hit one button, are they actually using that feature, right? So some of those things where we thought and the customer thought, like, yes, let's deploy it, but it might take some more adoption or some more time. Maybe they didn't start using it for the first 3 months, but 6 months into it, it's like, wow, it really is. Meetings are starting in less than a minute, and uptime's great, and yeah, let's go build some more on this standard type of room, and you gotta have the
some of that information is really insightful when it comes to adding new features as well. I've definitely done stuff like that where you add a new feature and then behind the scenes track how often it gets used. And that way you can kind of present to the end user or your client that, you know, some of the stuff that they're asking for, their users aren't actually using.
Right.
That's a favorite one of mine too, because I give you a real world example. We had a customer that wanted to have dual presentation capabilities because the projector supported it. So we went out there and, you know, it was one of those jobs where you reprogram from scratch, right? But it's all just, so the point was like, yeah, let's simplify it. And so we had the discussion, like, do you really need to do two presentations at once? Like, well, no, well, like, maybe. So let's take it out for a little while, and then, you know, we'll come
see
back.
See if anybody misses it.
Yeah, does anyone miss it?
Let's do a beta room.
And, of course, you know, we never went back to add it up, but, you know, and so that those are just as important, right, to take things away as it is to add them.
I find that there's nothing more frustrating as a programmer is a crazy client request, and the whole time you're making it work, you're thinking, nobody is ever going to use this feature, but, you know, somebody said, hey, it can do this, and so now it has to. So
it's a trap we can all fall in because, you know, we're simplifying the designs now, we're simplifying the hardware because everything's getting baked in. A lot of things are moving to software-based control. And we've always had a tendency to over-engineer systems, right? More complicated because there's so much to choose from. And the second mistake after over-engineering a system is really over-programming it, right? Programmers should know where to cut through to the user experience and not just, hey, I can route anything everywhere and now I can control everything anywhere. And when the user has a difficult time, it's a training issue. That is the wrong way to look at it.
Yeah, if your user needs training on your interface, you need to design a better interface.
Yeah, and we've developed that kind of approach. Now, there are some times where you will have an operator that needs to know how to do anything everywhere, but that's the one room or two rooms in an entire building where it's a boardroom that's getting managed by some white glove service, or it's the production room, sure. But yeah, the conference room, the basic huddle room, forget it. It should be walk in, get to work, and get out. It shouldn't take you 5 minutes to connect a call. And the tools that Crestron's been giving us to do that, I think, is making that much simpler.
I know we're getting short on time here, but I wanted to ask Dan one last question. Is there a favorite product that you've had in the whole time that you've been doing the R&D manager thing that you've seen kind of start to finish? Something that you've been, like, really super excited about?
What's your baby?
So,
yeah.
So when I was probably a year in when I did I was in the R&D group. So we have sort of two different groups. We have the R&D, and then we have the technology managers, which are the people that actually bring the products to market. So there's sort of a handoff. And when I started, I was in... I started directly in R&D, and I crafted the vision for what was to become digital media. And you know, my boss, Fred Barghezzi, our CTO, said, "That's great. It's an awesome vision you have. We have nobody to bring it to market. So guess who's going to bring it to market? You." And at the time, I was 24, 25. I had no idea what I was doing. You know, it was my passion, right? I was fresh out of the field. I knew all the frustrations directly from firsthand experience of everything everybody was feeling. And so that first product to come out was really like the 8x8. And to see that product still shining in 2016 and still going, I mean, it's absolutely incredible to think about. You know, when we came out with it, it was a 1080p product on original DM cable, these massive wires. And that same chassis is, I mean, incredibly successful. And it's still growing. It's going past 4K 60 on the same thing that's almost, you know, a 10-year-old architecture at this point, because we laid down such a solid groundwork there. And that makes me happy to see it continue like that, right? So it's, even though I've had to hand it off to other people.
It's your pride and joy.
Right, to see it still going. And it will. I mean, just, you know, knowing the groundwork that was laid there, you know, we built it. We originally wanted to do that whole thing over Ethernet, right? We wanted to craft a network IP solution back then. The technology wasn't there. So we crafted a dual solution. There's an Ethernet backplane on there from every single card, every single endpoint. And now you're starting to see those hybrid solutions too. So as you need to sort of mix in some IP video, some streaming video, all of a sudden those cards come out for streaming video. You're going to see cards for Air Media built right into the chassis. This chassis is going to live on for a long, long time. So that's kind of my baby, so, you know, seeing it keep going.
Now that you're more the managing portion of the R&D group, do you get a little jealous when you have to hand it off to somebody else to...
There's always to develop
something new on your platform.
Right, because, you know, internally you never think anybody will do as good a job as you will, even though it comes out and you're like, wow, they thought of some things that I didn't really, it's always tough, right? Because you always, you know, if you're passionate about technology, you want to be able to bring your vision out there. But, you know, at our size and scale, to be able to build all the solutions we build, you have to use all the smart people that we have to bring those to market.
Well, you have quite the baby there, so.
Yeah.
Proud parent.
Yeah.
Your kid's like almost ready for college.
Yeah, I know. It's gonna be. It's gonna be 18 probably at some point.
Well, we are running short on time. We have to let these fine gentlemen go because they have to actually work the show floor. But I want to thank you. We normally do kind of a lighthearted question at the end, but we. Infocom special. David said he had a trivia question for us.
Yes. Thank you, Hope. So we're surrounded by a lot of programmers here, so I went with a programming question. So could you tell me who is attributed for coining the term bug related to programming?
Oh, so the name?
The name.
Oh, or I know the story,
right.
But I don't know
I'm
the
going
name.
For the name.
I don't know the name.
I know the story. I don't know the name. No.
Okay, well, let's go with the name. Final questions. Take a guess. Any guesses?
I'm going to have to phone a friend on this one, and I'm going to phone
David
Thorson.
Put your Wikipedia away.
I'm going to pull out my giant iPad, but I can't type and talk at the same time.
So it comes from the 40s, Grace Hopper, who was a very early programmer, coined that term.
From when they were still working with vacuum tubes, found an actual moth in the machine.
Yeah, the relays.
That she pulled out. The problem was that the relays weren't clicking, and the problem was there was a moth, an actual bug in the machine
awesome.
That she ended up removing, and they asked what the problem was, and she goes, it's a bug.
She also created the first software compiler, so.
She's kind of my hero.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. That was a good trivia question. Any final thoughts, Chris?
No, I think this everybody did a great job. I think that we learned a lot about the R&D process at Crestron.
Yeah, and I'd like to just say, come check us out at our booth. We're in the North Hall. I know Crestron's here in the Central Hall, so AVSPL is on the floor again this year. We've got the Surface Hub. We've got some new announcements coming around Symfony, and we're focusing on, obviously, collaboration, transformation, the workspace, and we're also on a couple panels this week, so glad to be here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Floating Point on Rave Pubs Radio.